They wanted Iran to abandon this work as a result of these pressures. But we didn't and won't surrender. We did not and will not succumb to pressure on this issue, nor on any other issue. And now this guy, the American side, has dug his heels in, insisting that Iran mustn't have enrichment. Now others, the previous administrations, used to say that we shouldn't have high-level enrichment, or that we shouldn't keep the products of enrichment in the country. They used to say these things, which we didn't accept. But this one now says, don't have enrichment whatsoever, absolutely no enrichment. What does this mean? It means that this great achievement, one for which our country has worked so hard, gone to great costs, and endured so many difficulties, should be thrown away and destroyed. That's what having no enrichment means. Obviously, a nation with a strong sense of honor, like the Iranian nation, will slap anyone who suggests such a thing and refuses to accept it. So, this is what I wanted to say regarding enrichment. As for the next matter, which is the third topic, in the statements of political figures, the issue of negotiating with the U.S. is frequently raised. Well, there are differing views on this. As I have said, some consider it beneficial and necessary, some believe it's harmful, and others have more moderate opinions. Opinions vary. I wish to communicate to our dear nation what I have understood, seen, felt, and experienced over these many years.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of Israel's criminal behaviour and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we'll be examining who's behind the crisis at the BBC and how this relates to the corporation's coverage of Palestine and Israel. In our first report, Latif Rabu Chakra explains the role played by BBC board member Robbie Gibb in fomenting the upheaval in Britain's supposedly public service broadcaster.
An Israel lobby coup has taken place at the BBC with the resignation of Director General Tim Davey and new CEO Deborah Turness. But why have the Scottish First Minister, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Ed Davey, and the union representing the largest number of BBC workers, Bektu, responding to this news by calling for BBC board member Robbie Gibb to resign? Gibb was the key mover behind this coup and is working for foreign interests. He was part of a consortium which saved the Israel lobby rag, the Jewish Chronicle, alongside former chairman of the Charity Commission, William Shawcross, John Woodcock, former head of the Labour Friends of Israel, and Jonathan Sakadotti, former head of the Zionist Federation. Gibb was a co-founder of the rancid channel GB News, which has worked against the BBC from its very inception. Gibb also has a paid job for the Kext CNC PR company, founded by Israeli Gershon Kext, a chairman of the Weizmann Institute in Israel. Kext CNC is a subsidiary of Publicis Group, and according to an internal message from Global Chief Executive Officer Arthur Sadon, many staff have already been called up to the Israeli military for the genocide in Gaza. All of Gibb's media outlets outside of the BBC have been calling for Davy to resign for supposed pro-Palestinian bias for several years. Israel's Deputy Foreign Minister, Sharon Haxel, even publicly called for Tim Davy's resignation in June 2025. The primary catalyst for the resignations was a leaked internal dossier from Michael Prescott, a supposedly independent advisor to the BBC's editorial guidelines committee. This memo, leaked to the right-wing Daily Telegraph, specifically accused the BBC Arabic service of anti-Israel and pro-Hamas biases and minimizing Israeli suffering in its Gaza coverage. This report was set into motion by Gibb, who appointed Prescott to carry it out. Simultaneous to that, Prescott is employed by PR firm Hanover Communications, which works directly for Larry Ellison's Oracle firm. Ellison is so close to Netanyahu that he offered him directorship of Oracle and also is the highest individual donor to the Israeli military in history. The Board of Deputies has long expressed concerns about the BBC's anti-Israel bias and called for deep cultural change after the resignations, seeing them as the start of a renewal process. This was an Israel lobby coup.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeym University. Our guest contributor today is the author, broadcaster, investigative journalist, and former BBC insider, Tony Gosling. Welcome to the show. David, what do you know about this Robbie Gibb character and his role at the BBC?
Well, Robbie Gibb is the chief Zionist enforcer at the BBC. He's on the five-person editorial executive committee, which oversees all news and current affairs decisions. But he's not the only Zionist enforcer. There are many more, including on the executive committee. There are two or three others on the executive committee who are Zionists. And then further down the chain of command, there are many more in the newsroom, etc. But Gibb is a very interesting character. This is a guy who, of course, was involved with the Jewish Chronicle. The movement of the Jewish Chronicle from being an extremist Zionist organization to being an ultra-extremist Zionist organization. And of course, involved with, as the film showed there, with GB News. One of the interesting things about him, which is not widely known, is that he used to be a Western intelligence agent in the Soviet Union. And his brother, really? Both of them. His brother, of course, has been in a kibbutz in Israel. It's said that they're not Jewish, but they were the CIA, it looks like, in the Soviet Union, involved with an organization which also had previously had MI6 involvement, but MI6 had pulled out of that. So this is a guy who's got intelligence links and, of course, now has been central to the takeover of the Jewish Chronicle, in fact, in charge of that takeover.
Wow. Well, Tony, I mean, the BBC has a history, doesn't it, of MI5 vetting its employees, but how does what's happened here differ from that?
Well, look, I think we have to understand what the BBC is and what broadcasting is, how it fits in to the rest of the world, because it's a relatively new thing to be able to broadcast live people speaking in the last 100 years, really. And so really what broadcasting is nowadays is a new thing, which is like the nervous system of humanity. So people can in real time supposedly see what's going on in other parts of the world. And whether it works or not is in the 1920s set the BBC up, were aware that it could be used as a weapon of war. And that's why when they first started it, they came up with this slogan, "Nations shall speak peace unto nation," which was underneath the badge, you know, the sort of public BBC. And of course, it has actually, in my lifetime, I think, been co-opted But MI5, you're quite right, that's Britain's internal security service, were exposed in the 1980s by Mark Hollingsworth as vetting all the staff. I managed to get in by other routes. Basically, I knew some people who were news producers in London and got in that way. But if you were to try and go through many of their official procedures, someone like me is unlikely to have managed to get into the BBC. MI5 most definitely involved in that. And I think we're now in the situation where that has become absolutely embedded in the corporation. You've got, not just the BBC, in other private broadcasters and newspapers in the capital. So, for example, home affairs correspondents will all be basically public relations people for MI5, attached to the Home. The Foreign Affairs stable of journalists all pretty much saying the same kind of thing, associated with an MI6 point of view. In terms of finance, we've got the UK budget this week. You'll find all of the London correspondents looking at finance are being told what to think by the City of London and vetted by the City of London. So what we've got does not reflect society whatsoever anymore. It just reflects these sorts of elite institutions, as you mentioned, like MI5.
Yes, indeed. And in terms of the Zionist impact, though, Attorney, just say a word about that. I mean, obviously, talk about the MI5, I mean, and you've sort of set that out very, very clearly. But just say, I mean, does this differ from what's gone before? I mean, what's going on now?
Well, OK, so I started at the BBC in the late 1980s as a researcher and then went on to do reporting and journalism. I was there at a very interesting time because in 1911, Victor Rothschild, who was part of the Rothschild family, a very influential Labour peer, spoke to Marmaduke Hussey, who writes about it in his autobiography, who was the chairman at the BBC at the time. And he said to Marmaduke Hussey, can I see the director? So that was what was going on in the Thatcher era, because Alistair Milne was the director general of the BBC, who's basically like the chief editor there, and he was doing programmes which were critical of the Thatcher government. They had a panorama which was exposing the far right within the Conservative Party. I found it interesting that it was actually Victor Rothschild that broached the subject of getting rid of that director general. And then they replaced him with Michael Checkland, who was an accountant, and then with John Burt, who was the director general when I was working there.
Let me just move on to David, though, now, if I may. Tony, because we haven't got too much time, and I just wanted to get your thoughts, David, about, I mean, Latifa, as we heard, referred to this guy Michael Prescott in her report. I mean, just say a bit more about his role.
Well, this is yet another of the very many issues corruption within these processes. So Prescott had a dual role. He was working to the BBC, and also for this PR firm, which of course has got all sorts of other clients, including of course working for the big tech firms, including Oracle, run by Larry Ellison, the guy who's just taken over TikTok and CBS, yes, and is looking to take over other media platforms in the US, international media platforms. And of course, if they can, they want to take over as many media platforms as they can. And so that's what's behind this coup at the BBC, is an attempt to make sure that nobody in the mainstream media or in social media is able to be critical of the genocide.
Right, okay. Well, Tony, I mean, why do you think Israel and its lobby groups then are so fixated on the BBC?
Well, of course, it's because they want to create the impression that what the Israelis are doing is correct and right. Back in the 1990s, we had Zionists appearing in our newsroom. They come from outside broadcasting. It was questionable whether they were actually competent broadcasters, but they were pro-Israel. And there were lots of people raising eyebrows around our production office, Marylebone and High Street, at Greater London Radio at the time, to see these people popping out of nowhere. So the process, I think, began in the late 1980s, early 1990s, including these kind of basically Zionist agents. Yeah. The idea really, I think, is to manipulate the public opinion In fact, on a couple of occasions, I've had producers say to me, well, we haven't told the public what to think yet. And so there's an enormous amount of power in this whole broadcasting idea. But remember, they're speaking to less and less people. If you look at the Press Gazette's annual returns, you'll find that now it's a steady two-thirds, 65-70% of people in Britain don't trust what they see in the mass media anymore.
No, indeed.
So they've lost about two-thirds of the people.
I think that probably explains one of the reasons why the Zionist entity has lost the battle for public opinion, Tony. And I guess, you know, obviously the BBC still likes to trade on its sort of reputation, as it were, as being a trustworthy source. And maybe that's another reason why the Zionist entity is so fixated on it. But David, I mean, the Middle East, BBC's Middle East editor of their news website, Rafi Berg, I mean, just say a bit about him, will you, and his role in all this as well.
Well, I mean, Berg is clearly a very important element of this, but he's not the only one. I mean, there are Zionists spread throughout the corporation, and these are effectively Zionist gatekeepers. But Rafi Berg has become the most well-known because there's been stories about him, and of course there's this recent libel action which he is taking against Owen Jones, which I think is almost guaranteed to fail. But Berg is a fan of Netanyahu, who's written about the derring do of the Mossad, and he still remains in there as a kind of gatekeeper, along with many other Zionist gatekeepers inside the BBC, like there is in almost all of the other mainstream media outlets.
I'm trying to just get your thoughts, really, on this libel action that David just mentioned that Rafi Berg's taken against the Guardian columnist Owen Jones. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, people like Rafi Berg are literally embedded now within, it's almost like in the brain cells of humanity. They're making sure that they're acting like, as David said, as gatekeepers. This is their job. Anyone who gets through, it stops anyone getting through. I remember hearing from Craig Murray, who I know is a friend of yours, how several times there are taxis taking him to a television centre to appear on a live television programme, and then the taxi driver has to turn around and take him back because somebody like Rafi Berg, although he's an internet guy actually, has intervened. I mean, that seems to me to be the whole role nowadays of many of these specific individuals. And they don't reflect the humanity. I am very concerned, though, about this attack on the BBC at the moment, because we've got a privately owned all the time, and the BBC is really the only counter to it from the public sector. And what we've seen over the years is cross-media ownership and a handful of media proprietors. We've just got the Daily Telegraph being taken over by Daily Mail and General Trust at the moment. It's falling into fewer and fewer hands, and it's not just broadcasters or radio or newspapers. It's also magazines and books, all forms of media.
Yeah.
In fact,
Tony, we're going to have to just move to our next report now, which looks at the fallout following the BBC's coverage of the Glastonbury Music Festival earlier this year.
Under international law, the right of people under colonial or foreign domination and foreign occupation to resist by all available means, including armed struggle, has been widely recognized and affirmed by numerous United Nations General Assembly resolutions. International law explicitly sanctions the targeting of occupying soldiers through armed operations. As occupied people, the Palestinians have the right to resist the Israeli occupation through armed resistance. However, punk rap duo Bob Villain has faced significant backlash and professional consequences, including canceled shows and revoked visas. Following pro-Palestinian comments made during their Glastonbury Festival set in June 2025. During their performance, lead singer Bobby Villain led the crowd in chants of Free, Free Palestine and Death, Death to the IDF. This reflects the view of numerous UN resolutions that Palestinians have the right to protect themselves against occupying soldiers through armed force. This incident at Glastonbury was used as a weapon to force Davy out of the BBC. Performance was live-streamed by the BBC, which later expressed regret for not cutting the feed, and it triggered a police investigation. Following a rabid Israeli lobby campaign, the band was dropped from several festivals and tours, including Radar Festival in Manchester, a show in France, and a German tour. In October 2025, they postponed two headline UK gigs in Manchester and Leeds, citing political pressure from figures like Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson and Zionist groups who called for the gigs to be cancelled. The U.S. State Department also revoked the duo's visa, forcing the cancellation of their North American tour. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau stated that
foreigners who glorify violence and hatred are not welcome visitors to our country.
Their booking agent, United Talent Agency, UTA, also ended its relationship with the duo. Bob Dylan's lead singer has stated he is not regretful of the chance and would do it again. In a statement, the band clarified that they're not calling for the death of Jews, Arabs, or any other race or group of people, but rather for the dismantling of a violent military machine, and that they are being targeted for speaking up. The rancid push to punish the group has been led by UK Lawyers for Israel and featured other less well-known lobby groups also. This call from the stage at Glastonbury featured heavily in the campaign against the BBC and was successfully used to force the resignation of Tim Davie despite his capitulation after the fact. The UK Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer even joined in condemning the comments as appalling hate speech, adding to the pressure on venues. Despite the campaign, both Palestinian Resistance and Bob Dylan still stand. The BBC, however, is a contested space.
Well, David, I mean, is what Bob Dylan said actually controversial in your opinion?
Well, it's become a very, very popular worldwide slogan. You hear it in demonstrations all over the world.
Yeah.
And of course, it was something which was unusual in the British public sphere, not so much in America at the time, but in the British public sphere at the time. But it's become, they said when they did it, well, let's not have any more vanilla slogans, let's have something serious. And that, and he was making a serious point about the need to dismantle the so-called Israel Defense Forces. And that, of course, that's what most young people now believe is necessary as a matter of simple policy.
Yeah.
So not controversial in that sense, but of course very controversial in the parallel universe of Zionist sense-making.
And
that, of course, causes them to clutch their pearls and lose all their combobulation and of course, to try and stop him and the duo from playing anywhere, including, in Manchester, and a whole panoply of Zionist organizations got together for that.
They used to silence opposition. But, Tony, when it comes to Israel, I mean, why does the BBC and the UK's corporate media seem to be so opposed to the application of international law?
Well, the fact is, I don't think they really are. It's just the people at the very top. If you look at the BBC's executive and its board, the foreign countries such as Israel take a great deal of interest in who is on those parts of the organisation and what their views are. And they're constantly trying to manoeuvre their people into those positions. But I think there will be many people in the BBC who will be cheering, privately maybe, without their bosses seeing, about Bobby Villain's comments in the summer. And isn't it interesting how that came out through the music and entertainment arm? Because the current affairs arm and the news arm of the BBC is so totally controlled. What we should be seeing is people like Glenn Deason, Jeffrey Sachs, Colonel Douglas McGregor, Scott Ritter on the news every evening. Very good experts. But they're being gatekept by people like Bobby Villain. And the other thing to mention is it's great to see live performances, live television, live radio, etc. is far cheaper to produce than pre-recorded, but they like to pre-record everything nowadays, even though it's much more expensive, because then they can control
they
it
can control
things
it.
They don't want to see.
No, indeed. Let me just move on to you, David. I mean, what do you know about this United Talent Agency then that dropped Bob Dylan after the Glastonbury festival?
Well, this is one of a number of talent agencies based in the US, and in common with much of the entertainment industry, there's an iron grip of Zionist executives at the top of it. One of its first attempts to make sure that no one would mention Palestine was when it dropped Susan Sarandon in late 2023, and of course they've dropped Bob Dylan now. This is part of the way in which Zionists are able to control entertainment firms, Hollywood movie companies, the music industry itself. Zionists at the top of all of these companies, and this is something which we, of course, have remarked on this show before, but it's something which people don't understand very well, that actually the Zionists are able to actually run these companies and are massively overrepresented at the top of them.
Yes, indeed, and when we point that out, and people point that out, they sort of accuse us of indulging in anti-Semitism. It's
of course
an
do.
Extraordinary state of affairs, isn't it? But Tony, in the past, I know that you made the assertion that before entering frontline politics, Tony Blair was NMI5 asset who was spying on the campaign for nuclear disarmament. I mean, do you still stand by that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this all came out in conversations with the former MI5 officer, Annie Machon. She actually spoke to the editor of the Sunday Times, and they knew, Blair knew, that people from MI5 were out speaking in her and her former partner, David Shaler. And Blair was incredibly nervous because he knew that they may have seen his MI5 files. They keep these things very secret. And so he was really scared. So, yes, definitely, this is a massive interference in democratic politics, the secret services nowadays, who, of course, are a kind of form of permanent government. And they have got so arrogant that they just think that they can direct political affairs. And as you can see around the world, particularly in the West here, you see similar laws being passed in all sorts of countries and a mass increase in mass.
Yes, it's indeed.
So difficult for institutions to carry on. It's because all of the people at the top of those institutions, whether it be journalists, politicians or whatever, are all under surveillance constantly.
Yeah. Well, David, I mean, just going back to Bob Villain then, I mean, do you think he's likely to be charged?
No, I mean, we've seen a lot of these kinds of threats in the last year against anti-Zionists, and almost all of them have come to nothing. I mean, there was the alleged charges that were going to be thrown at NECAP, who were the ones whose live show at Glastonbury was removed, and Bob Villain replaced it. And, of course, that's what led to that whole story. So, no, Bob Villain is not going to be charged. NECAP have not been charged. Anti-Zionists are winning every week now cases in court. There was recently a case even in the US which has declared that anti-Zionist views are not anti-Semitic and should be protected. So we're winning this battle. And, of course, you know, they may have some victories now and again, but the tide is turning against their ability to impose whatever they want.
And, of course, you've been in the vanguard of that struggle in the UK, haven't you, to make anti-Zionist views a protected characteristic in employment law. But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today, so I'd like to thank our guest, Tony Gosling, and make a date to join us again on Palestine Declassified next week, when I'll be back alongside David Miller with more revelations and information that you won't find in the corporate media. But until then, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum. This is Hussein, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about Quranic teachings, Islamic concepts pertaining to humanity. And in a couple of last episodes, we started covering a very good book in this regard titled A 250-Year-Old Person, which is a combination of the lectures and sermons delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei in this regard. And it covers basically the life style and the manners of the Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the great leaders of Muslim community from his pure progeny, especially the socio-political aspect of their lives, because it helped us this analysis and understanding these elements from or lessons from their stories. It helps us understand more about Islamic teachings, because these individuals, great personalities of Islam, are role models, and they exemplified all those virtues and qualities that the Quran wants us to follow according to that holy verse of the Holy Quran, وَلَكُمْ فِي رَسُولِ اللَّهِ أُسْوَةٌ حَسَنًا. In the life of the Prophet of Islam, there is a good example for you to follow. Now, we were talking about, in the first chapter, we were talking about the life of the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, especially about him as a leader of Muslim community. We were talking about the challenges that he faced from the beginning of the start of his mission, the challenge posed by pagans and the challenge posed by Jewish communities, and then we talked about the challenge posed by munafiqun, hypocrites. So we said that there is a crucial and very beautiful distinction between the behavior that the Prophet showed toward munafiqun as individuals having evil intentions and problems and hatred. As long as it was at the personal level, the Prophet did not have any problem with that. Actually, he would embarrass them and humiliate them and humble them with his great akhlaq. Now, the person would encounter the Prophet with rude behavior. Like at the time of war, they created jokes, they mocked him. If you remember, at the Battle of Trench, we said that it was very difficult and intense situation for Muslims. And in all of the front lines, you see the Prophet ﷺ. He himself would help people to dig the trench. He was in the front line. Amir al-Mu'mineen, who is the bravest of all, according to all historical accounts. Now he says that kunna idha ihmarra al-ba's, when the fight would get very intense. Ahmarra means get red. When something gets hot, and it is hot that it becomes red like the iron. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says when the battle would get too intense, kunna ittaqayna bi rasulillah, we would get refuge before, or we would go, we would try to rescue ourselves, to save ourselves behind the Prophet. We would take shield behind the Prophet. And no one was closer to the enemy than the Prophet in those situations. Remember, I said that we have two kinds of leadership. The leadership that says go and go. The leadership that says come and come. So the leadership of the Prophet was come and come. He would go according to this testimony of the Amir al-Mu'mineen. And do not take it lightly, because Amir al-Mu'mineen, among the companions of the Prophet, he was the bravest according to all accounts. That some of the companions, they had calculations. You don't see anyone that, I mean, some of them, you don't see them killing anyone because they had calculation. They feared the pagans. They did not trust the message and the mission of the Prophet to succeed. So they were thinking, what happens if this fails? These pagans are going to kill us afterward. So they would not kill anyone because they were not brave enough. But Amir al-Mu'mineen, in the battles, his role was decisive and crucial. And this person says, no one was closer to enemy than any of us. So we're going to have a break and come back.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa.
Welcome back. This is Hossein, and you're listening to a program for humanity. We were talking about the issue of munafiqun, and we said that, or hypocrites in Muslim community, and we said that even though that the Prophet was the bravest of all, he would not encounter munafiqun with, iron fist or suppress them, crack down, no. As long as it was a personal, individual thing. He would actually show them respect and in a way that sometimes other companions would protest and would say that these are munafiqun, these are hypocrites. They made fun of us at the Battle of Trench when it was very difficult. And they would say, especially about the promises of the Prophet. The Prophet said, okay, you're going to conquer Persia and Roman, and these people were hungry, it was very cold. You can just imagine the situation. Because of the coldness, it was kind of famine in that area. And then it was very cold, they were under siege. And then the Jewish community of Banu Qurayza had already betrayed them or posing a threat to them to kill their families. So they were in this intense situation, and then the Prophet said, okay, you're going to... And these munafiqun would mock the Prophet by saying that nobody has the... cannot dare to go out, to do his personal stuff. But then he tells you, he gives you the false promise of... مَا وَعَدَنَ اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ إِلَّا غُرُورًا. Quran says they would tell other companions that whatever that has been given to you is a false wishes. It's not going to taking place. But then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala guided the Prophet, and also with the great manners of the Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he did not encounter them harshly, these munafiqun, hypocrites, although they would create a lot of trouble. But then, when these people tried to have an organized campaign, like for example, Masjid al-Dharar, the Mosque of Dharar, they got together, they had like organized meetings, and they actually made a link to a person called Abu Amr, who was a person linked to the Roman Empire at that time, and it was a kind of conspiracy going on that they wanted to plot against the Muslim community of that time. Then the Prophet did not waste any time. Immediately he went to their mosque and he burned that mosque down according to verses of the Holy Quran. This should be destroyed. This is not personal liberty. This is a political campaign against the Muslim community about the security issue. Okay? So this is it. As long as it is a personal, individual hatred or anything or stubbornness, then that is, they have all the rights. Even those people, they would receive their allowance from Baytul Mal. All the rights and privileges of a citizen they had. Abdullah bin Ubay, who was the munafiq, well-known munafiq of the time, the Prophet did not do anything to him. He would give them their share from Baytul Mal, allowance and everything. But then if they wanted to, they plotted against them, they had a plan to have an organized campaign against Muslims, whether in terms of cultural campaign or political campaign, then that's a different issue. And then you should not waste the time. And this is what we learn from the seerah of the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Inshallah, we're going to continue discussion in the next episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
It's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to you all. You are listening to Iran Radio from Tehran. We start this hour's lineup with our varied radio productions feature. That will be followed by Olima's speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. And after that, we have Viewpoint. The program presents an analytical roundtable discussion of various political and social issues of the Islamic world today.
On September 22, 1980, when the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people was not yet 2 years old, Saddam attacked Iran with the green light from the U.S. Former Iraqi dictator had signed a peace agreement with Mohammad Reza Pahlavi 5 years earlier, which had ended his border disputes with Iran. But just a few days before issuing the order to attack, much like the U.S. president who tore up the JCPOA agreement, he appeared openly and confidently on television and declared all his commitments with Iran null and void. Forty-five years later, with a 12-day imposed war, all these memories were revived for Iranians. This time, with America's green light, Benjamin Netanyahu, instead of Saddam, attacked Iran at a moment when indirect negotiations between Tehran and Washington were underway to supposedly resolve Iran's nuclear file peacefully. Now the entire world was waiting to see whether, just as Iranians under the guidance of their leader in the 8-year war with Saddam managed to force the enemy into accepting a ceasefire and defeat, in the second imposed war, the Israeli regime and its supporters would also be compelled to retreat or not. The Israeli regime's assessment was that, given Iran's chronic economic problems and social divisions, After a lightning military strike, spontaneous protest cells would emerge, and what happened in Syria would be repeated in Iran as well. Thus, it was that June 13th marked the beginning of a difficult time for Iranians. According to the planners of this attack, with the assassination of high-ranking generals, the situation in Iran would become so chaotic that higher groups and counter-revolutionaries could seize control of parts of Tehran, such as Mehrabad Airport and its surrounding areas, from the police and security forces. This was deemed to cause the conditions. Through street chaos, special forces would be airlifted into Iran, pushing the structure of Iran's government to the brink of collapse within a matter of days. The name of this operation had already been determined, True Promise 3. With operations True Promise 1 and 2, the IRGC in its first missile response did exactly what the regime had anticipated, using a large number of missiles so that the Israelis would feel assured that Iran's missile response pattern had not changed. The Israeli army assumed that by Iran's numerous launches, the locations of its missile systems would be exposed, and subsequently, under aerial strikes, another portion of the Islamic Republic's missile capability could be destroyed.
But we've not seen the pictures of it and been able to assess the nature of the damage because Israeli sensors have blocked that. But we also know that Iran hit and damaged, and in some cases destroyed, the Israel's version of the Pentagon, Israel's version of the CIA, Israel's version of the FBI, Israel's version of the National Security Agency. Israel has two seaports where containers come into the country and where exports leave the country. Iran shut those down. So wow. There was no more seatime, maritime traffic coming in and out of the port. Iran also destroyed the two oil refineries or interrupted their ability to process and produce fuel. The oil refineries at Haifa and Ashdod, which is also the places where the ports are located. Iran shut down the only international airport in Israel. So nobody was getting in and out of the country unless they went to a military airfield and got out on a military aircraft. But all of the military airfields in Israel were also hit.
I'm actually, so this is, it's more of a town, really, just on the outskirts of Tel Aviv, called Rishon Zion. I am surrounded right now. If I look in every direction, there are a crew of about 12 emergency workers just in front of me now going patrolling houses everywhere around the streets here. There's the detritus of the strikes that happened at 5 a.m. this morning in this neighborhood. And just around the corner from me is the, well, what is now a crater, which used to be homes, where two people died.
But that was not the whole story. Israel's costly and expensive attacks carried out with repeated NATO aircraft refueling in the skies not only wore down equipment, but also imposed numerous financial, security, and logistical constraints on Israel and its allies. For this reason, contrary to the bluffs of the Zionist officials, this war was supposed to end very quickly with a decisive victory. Yet Iran, by changing its defensive tactics, decided that, contrary to the enemy's design, the war should become long and attritional, so that Israel would be punished by accepting defeat and a ceasefire would be dictated to them.
Iran has stood up against it. Iran has the admiration and respect of the entire Arab world. The people in the Arab world that are not respected, that everybody loathes, are the ruling elites, because they are seen as eagerly selling everybody out for money and stability. So this war is going to continue for that reason. The other reason is that you can't leave Iran in place if you're an Israeli, because you've determined that they cannot be subjugated. If they can't be subjugated, if they won't submit to Israeli supremacy, inevitably they're going to come back and threaten Israel.
You get what Israel got, and basically, I don't know, they probably will not recover from this, at least in any time soon, if ever, actually. And you look at actually at some quarters of Tel Aviv or Beersheba, or it's just freaking like World War III then.
Missile responses were so effective and unexpected that they quickly alarmed the West about Israel's imminent defeat.
Maltese.
Thus, on the fourth and fifth days of the war, the leaders of the G7 gathered to take action in support of Israel. From that moment, it became clear that if the U.S. did not directly enter the field, Israel would be buried under the weight of Iran's missile strikes. For the White House, a strange situation arose. On the one hand, the fragile state of America's energy market, economy, and security was such that it could not enter into an intense war with Iran. On the other hand, it could not remain indifferent to the heavy blows that were pressuring its most important proxy force in the region. Therefore, an historic gamble fraught with uncertainties, it decided to attack the nuclear facilities at Natanz, Fordo, and Isfahan. Immediately after this incident, Trump threatened Iran with consequences if it responded in any way, and declared the time for a ceasefire and the end of the war had arrived.
And, you know, I listened to President Trump not too long ago say that Israel is winning. And, of course, this is the mantra in the mainstream media. But the question you have to ask yourself is, what does winning mean? It's a meaningless comment by itself.
If under these circumstances, Iran had accepted a ceasefire, the United States would have succeeded in pulling Israel honorably out of the quagmire of war with Iran. But shortly after the U.S. Army's attack, Iran once again targeted Israeli-occupied territories with intense and devastating strikes. This time, the IRGC both changed its firing pattern and unleashed a large, energetic barrage upon Israel. Releasing images of widespread destruction in occupied territories evoked Israeli army's assaults on Gaza. But the IRGC's missile campaign was not yet over. On the evening of June 23rd, the armed forces of the Islamic Republic carried out a precise attack named Bisharat al-Fath, glad tidings of victory, against the Al Udeid base in Qatar, using the same number of projectiles that the U.S. had employed in its strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Although the Islamic Republic did not use its new generation missiles in this attack, the Americans, despite conducting the largest Patriot air defense operation in history, still failed to intercept all of the projectiles. In the end, 6 out of the 14 missiles launched hit their targets. Al Udeid base in Qatar is considered the most valuable strategic asset of the U.S. military in the region and serves as the headquarters of CENTCOM's Air Command. Alongside the operations True Promise 3 and Glad Tidings of Victory, the network of espionage and sabotage agents inside Iran, which had cost years of investment in training, equipping, and organizing, was being destroyed through vigilance of the people and the efforts of the Basij, security, and law enforcement forces. At the same time, the extraordinary cohesion of Iranians elevated the social capital of Iran to its highest point, and under the guidance of the commander-in-chief, public demands for punishing the aggressor grew stronger. Simultaneously, the measures of state officials to manage affairs and coordinate with the armed forces constantly conveyed to the world the message that Iran, united and in one voice, is ready for a long and powerful defense of its country. It was at this point that the regime had to find a solution for this dire situation. The intensity of the attacks and repeated crossing of red lines, such as targeting places like Evin Prison and medical centers on the 11th day, was for this reason.
Well, the thing you want to remember is that the Israelis depend very heavily on the idea or the notion that they have military superiority over everybody in the region, that they are invincible. And if they start a war and they lose that war, they don't win that war, and indeed it looks like Iran wins the war, this is a significant defeat for Israeli deterrence. It's just something that's almost unthinkable. They started this war thinking that they were going to win a relatively easy victory, and they were going to do to Iran what has been done to Syria. But that's not going to happen. The Iranians are going to stay in this fight. You want to remember that Iran fought against Iraq for 8 years, from 1980 to 1988.
Man, those days we were on Iraq's side, right?
That's correct. So the Iranians, I think, will stay in the fight. And I don't think Israel can maintain this fight over the long term.
By now, the enemies of the Iranian nation were grasping for breath, especially under the weight of global condemnations, which, with the fatwas of great religious authorities, such as Grand Ayatollah Sistani, further tightened the pressure on the U.S. and Zionist regime. If Iran's attacks on occupied territories had continued, if Iranian missiles had targeted other U.S. military bases in the region, if the oil and economic interests of the West had been damaged, if resistance groups in the region